Good evening and welcome to the today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Sarah Varney, health reporter for KQED Public Radio in San Francisco and your moderator for tonight's program. Today's program is underwritten by the California Healthcare Foundation. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org and the foundation at chcf.org. In today's discussion, we'll hear about new ways to approach patient care in the U.S., For patients and their loved ones, making the right medical choices can be daunting. There's competing and often incomplete information, insurance coverage restrictions, and often no trusted physician or nurse to help navigate the best course of treatment. We'll explore all these questions with tonight's panelists. We're going to start with Dr. Jennifer Brokaw. She's the founder of Good Medicine, a private medical and advocacy group helping patients navigate healthcare decisions. She has also been a practicing emergency room physician and teacher at several San Francisco hospitals. Next to her is Sean Duffy. He's the co-founder and CEO of Omada Health, a web-based lifestyle program for people with pre-diabetes who are seeking to fill the treatment gap left by the medical system. Marty Tenenbaum is the founder of Cancer Commons, a web-based open science initiative bringing together patients, physicians, and scientists to lead to better therapies. And Dr. Wayne Pan is the chief medical officer at Pacific Partners Management Services. With more than 20 years in the healthcare industry, Mr. Pan has worked in clinical medicine, molecular biology research, managed care, and health IT. Healthcare attracts many a talented and smart entrepreneur because, well, the industry from top to bottom has what is almost an existential problem. If costs can't be brought under control, making healthcare more affordable to those who have it and accessible to those who don't, the whole enterprise is at stake. So my first question is to Dr. Pan. Since, as far as I can gather, your company helps physicians run their businesses, and I do many other things, so you can tell us a little bit more about that. But where on your list of concerns of physician concerns is the cost to the patients?
So I work for Pacific Partners. It's a management company that manages the managed care business, which is the HMO business for physicians in Santa Clara County. We have about 800 multi-specialty physicians that we manage the contracts for. And in terms of costs, for the average practicing physician, the cost really doesn't come into play other than what they get in terms of capitation or payments from fee-for-service. However, from a management standpoint, it's very important because what happens is the health insurance companies come to us and basically want to negotiate lower rates in order for them to be able to turn around and then offer products to sell to employers. So it's not necessarily at the clinical level, but it's certainly at the management level that costs are being very carefully looked at and managed.
Just talk a little bit more about capitation and explain to folks what that model is.
So capitation is a way that you're paying in advance, essentially, for services. And in Northern California, we primarily do what's called partial capitation. So as a medical group, we are essentially delegated the responsibility to pay and manage outpatient services. That includes professional services like seeing your physician, seeing specialists, and then also outpatient services such as radiology, laboratory, things like that. So we actually get a portion of the premiums that are paid by your employer to the health plan, and the health plan gives a portion of that to the medical group to manage. The other portion is actually the inpatient side, and that's actually paid directly by the health plan, although we manage that, and we will tell the health plan how to pay for those services in the hospital.
And we'll come back to some of the things that you brought up, but I want to go to Sean Duffy next. So your company is working on a product that's meant to identify people with pre-diabetes. So these are people who have a regular blood glucose, but not yet reaching the threshold of diabetes, I gather, and help, of course, bring it under control. So first, tell us how you do this.
Sure.
Fresh vegetables and exercise for everyone.
That certainly helps.
And then I imagine there's a lot of interest from, insurance companies who and employers who desperately want to get ahead of this problem.
Exactly.
Pitchwoman for your company?
You should, actually. It's wonderful. So Omada Health is building a web program for people with prediabetes to reduce the risk they progress to diabetes. The important background for this is that in 2002, there was this big clinical trial that finished up called the Diabetes Prevention Program. And as part of this trial, they took people with prediabetes through a 16-week lifestyle course, which helped them learn about diabetes, helped them eat a little better, more fruits and vegetables, helped them exercise a bit more, and lose a specific amount of weight. And in 3 years, this reduced the risk of getting diabetes by 58%. It's an enormous clinical result. And the difficulty there was it's tough to bring this program to the world because it turned out that the metaphorical pill for prediabetes was a lifestyle program. So that's what my company is trying to do. So there's a lot of clinical evidence that shows it's possible to prevent diabetes. And yes, because the costs are enormous of that conversion, as it triggers a medical protocol, insurance companies and self-insured employers are starting to wake up to these costs.
So there are other tools like this already on the market, right?
There are some. There's not a program specifically designed to take this clinical literature and bring it to the web. And then the way we're doing things as part of Amada Health is very unique to the market. There's nothing quite like our
product. So the idea would be an insurance company would buy your mm-hmm. product and then give mm-hmm. it to or a self-insured employer.
They would choose to pay for it. So right now the experience you have as a patient with prediabetes is you go into your doctor, you find out you have prediabetes, and you're told to lose weight, exercise. You're probably told that it's absolutely possible to avoid getting diabetes. But you're not necessarily instructed how to do that, and you might not have the support to do it. So we want to be essentially a treatment for the diagnosis of prediabetes. And so there'll be a handoff from finding out you have prediabetes, which could come from a doctor, it could come from an employer screening, to us. And then we'll bring you through the curriculum from this original clinical trial.
And we'll come back to much of what you're talking about, because, of course, one of the big issues now is the pre-anything, the pre-hypertension, the pre-diabetes, pre-death.
Sure.
So Marty Tenema, we have kind of a disparate group up here, so I just want to give them all a chance to talk a little bit about their companies and what they do, and then we'll start to weave it together. So Marty, you've started something called Cancer Commons, and maybe just first explain to people exactly what it is and where you got the idea from.
Well, I got the idea from firsthand experience. 10 years ago, I was diagnosed with metastatic melanoma. It's a really dire prognosis. I went to many different physicians, got many different suggestions of what to do. And you ever get the feeling that you're like in this maze with no zagots to guide you? It's overwhelming. It's frightening. And there was just, suddenly you have all these urgent life and death decisions with full of uncertainty and just none of the information and data that you need. My background was computer science, machine learning, internet entrepreneur. I do everything. But I couldn't navigate my way through this. And I vowed that if I could get my health back, I would do something about it. So that's how I got to do what I'm doing. Today, we're in an amazing position with all of the progress that's come from the Human Genome Project and now the Cancer Genome Atlas and the price breakthroughs in which we're going to have $1,000 genomes hitting the clinic within 6 months. And there's very few doctors or patients who have the knowledge that's needed to translate that information, that data, into actionable treatments based on the molecular characteristics of your tumor. So none of this could be done 10 years ago, but today it is possible to be able to have your tumor sequenced and based on that, to be able to, based on the best of our knowledge, find the optimal treatments and trials. And what Cancer Commons is trying to do is build the knowledge base that everyone needs to be able to take the 100,000 papers that are published every year in cancer and the results of the 10,000 clinical trials and reduce that through web-based collective intelligence, machine learning, and applications, expert systems that can make this information available in a useful form so that patients and physicians can make the right choice for them based on the molecular subtype of their tumor and then close the loop, learn as much as we can from every patient in order to be able to do better for the next patient, and then escape this tyranny of, 7-year-long or 2-year-long publication cycles in which things get peer-reviewed and whatever. The idea is to be able to get the information to the people who need it, namely the very next patient coming along, as soon as possible so that we can save lives.
So this is an application, you were showing it to us on your iPad in the back room. Mm-hmm. This is an application that physicians would use, although you also said patients, but maybe just first talk about physicians would use. It would say, I have a patient who has this particular kind of cancer. They've tested for these particular genes or mutations. And then there's a big, long list of thousands and thousands of trials. Wow. And then it recommends what?
Well, there's a long list of thousands and thousands of trials. If you go to clinicaltrials.gov, which has an exhaustive listing of cancer trials, if you go to Cancer Commons, what you'll find is a very pruned down list of the 20 or so trials that are recommended for someone with your precise molecular subtype of cancer, to the best of our knowledge. Much of the information is based on previous clinical trials, but there's a small rub, which is in the molecular age, we know that cancer is many thousands of distinct genomic diseases. And even a single patient may have multiple diseases going on at once because of just lots of mutations. And so the idea of using a clinical trial, which is using population statistics to say that, you know, in this trial 50% of the patients responded well, in this trial 20% of the patients responded well, doesn't really give much guidance, because are you more similar to these 50% or these 20%? And so what Cancer Commons is trying to do in a sentence is basically turn every patient into an N of one experiment, a clinical trial, and to treat that patient to the best of our knowledge for that patient subtype, and then learn everything we can from them. And the one other point I'd like to make, Sarah, is that in practice today in oncology, every day there are thousands of patients who are beyond standard of care. If you're in standard of care, there are guidelines. You follow those. Beyond standard of care, you and your doctor are just trying all kinds of things, off-label or in cocktails, in a desperate attempt to find out what might be right for you. Thousands of times a day, these experiments go on, and no one captures any of that learning. You know, 3 or 5% of the patients go into clinical trials, and there they even capture a small amount. But all of these experiments that happen every day in oncology, no one captures. That's what we're trying to do in Cancer Commons.
Right. Now, Dr. Brokaw, you're from the company Good Medicine, and you're kind of like the bat phone for patients and their families trying to figure out what to do. From what I understand, if I've been in a hospital, I've discharged, I go home, I have all these pieces of paper from the hospital, none of which I can really understand. You essentially come in and help me organize what I'm supposed to be doing once I get home. Is that about right?
Well, I hope that we've met you before you've left the hospital.
Okay.
Actually, and the sooner we meet our clients, the better for everyone. Although, you know, we do tend to get the crisis calls. So, my sister's in the hospital. Things aren't going well. Can she have an advocate there? And we will show up at the bedside with, you know, we're outsiders. We're not privileged specifically at any hospital. We're not employed by any hospital system or any health plan. We are there as employees of the patient. And we show up with our permission slip from the patient that we can be involved in their care. And we try to shepherd them from that inpatient hospital experience to the home setting, which is one of the most dangerous transitions you can make in medicine. Last week was Patient Safety Week, Awareness Week, and there was a statistic published that was very controversial about 15 years ago when it was first published by the Institute of Medicine about the number of people who die from healthcare-related deaths. It was 90,000 reported at that time per year, and the statistic that they put forth this time was 120,000. And probably it's not because the deaths have gone up so much, but that they're tracking data better. A lot of this patient safety stuff is written into the Affordable Care Act. The hospitals are going to be held accountable for how many hospital-acquired infections you have, whether you get readmitted within a certain period after being discharged from the hospital. But sadly, you know, for whatever reason, and it really does come down to money, hospitals have not been incentivized to do the right things, to reduce harm. And but there is a real new awareness and focus on patient harm, and we come at it from the consumer perspective. We're not trying to save money for the hospital at all. We're just trying to get our patient home alive and understanding what they need to do once they get home. That's one branch of our business. Another branch of our business is what we like to say proactive as opposed to reactive. We're very big fans and proponents of the idea of advanced care planning, which is a term that I think more and more people will start hearing about. And it really is about planning for your eventual illness and demise, and allowing the people in your family who will be making decisions for you or at your bedside when that time comes, know what your wishes are and what you would and would not want to go through. And most importantly, what quality of life would you like to have ultimately? What's the minimum quality of life you would accept for yourself so that in the moment when medical decisions need to be made, it can be made in the context of a narrative that you yourself have conveyed to your healthcare proxies. And your healthcare proxies are somebody that you name in your family or a friend or your primary physician, or it might be your cardiologist, whoever's treating you the most intimately, your trust and estate attorney. The more you can disseminate these wishes and this narrative, and it really goes beyond the traditional advanced directive, which just talks about, do you want CPR or not? Do you want to be on a ventilator or not? Nothing's ever that cut and dry. I was an ER doctor. I was an ER doctor for 15 years, and I think one of the things that spurred me to do this kind of work was the resuscitations that I knew were not supposed to be happening. So the very old or infirm person, the person who was clearly at an advanced stage of illness, coming in on a stretcher with the paramedics doing compressions and having to do a very aggressive procedure on that person and basically guaranteeing them a very cold death, you know, a very technological death. A mentor of mine once used the analogy that in India they put their dead on a funeral pyre and push them out into the Indus River, but in America we load them up with tubes and IVs and hook them up to a bunch of machines and send them off into the night, you know, of blinking machines. And I really feel strongly that we're ready in this country to talk about these things in a more realistic manner. And it turns out that what's good for the patient will be good for the healthcare system. It's not about death panels. It's really about respecting choices. That's a program that we subscribe to.
So the first part of your business, which you were talking about kind of managing care for somebody who's in a complex situation, I mean, a lot of this is, you know, gets back to this concept of the medical home, which sounds very, you know, commonsensical, right? You have a person who's, or a team of doctors or nurses and medical assistants who are in charge of managing your care. I was actually, was just down in LA last week, and you all know Dr. Mitch Katz, who used to run the public health system here in San Francisco, has been lured down to LA to fix their massively messed up system. And he's impaneled 250,000 patients in the last 6 months into this concept of medical home. So it's not just in fancy hospitals that we're doing this. Of course, it's the public systems feel like they need to do this or die. And I guess I'm just wondering, maybe from each of you, and just jump in, maybe Dr. Pan, what's the impediment to this? I mean, is it nobody wants to pay for it? The system is just simply so fractured that unless you have something like a Kaiser has taken a long time to get to where they have now completed, in a way, medical homes, what's getting in the way of this concept from really spreading?
Well, I think it's really payment, right? I mean, if you think about it, if you look at the way the system is set up, hospitals, for example, are not interested at all in making sure patients don't come back to the hospital because they get paid every time a patient comes back in. So there's no interest for the hospital to tell their primary care doctor that, oh, by the way, Mrs. Smith has been discharged. You might want to take a look at her within a couple days. Otherwise, she may come back in because if she comes back in, the hospital gets paid again. And same thing with the individual providers. The individual providers are not paid to manage the care coordination that's necessary with our fractured system. So when a PCP may send a patient to a cardiologist, the PCP doesn't have
that's a primary care.
Yeah, primary care. Right, I'm sorry. Primary care physician sends a patient to a cardiologist. That PCP doesn't necessarily have the staff to follow that patient to make sure the patient actually got to the cardiologist. And then when the cardiologist receives the patient, he or she doesn't have any information about why the patient's even there. So all this stuff requires manpower to sort of make the system smoother. And right now, we're not really paying for that. And so medical homes is a concept where all the providers are taking care of a particular patient are on the same page. And we're hoping that we can get technology to support that. So if there's a common medical record, for example, like in Kaiser, when you see a doctor, you have one record there at Kaiser, and that record goes with you wherever you are. Same thing in the community, you would want the same thing to happen. So when the PCP is sending the patient to the cardiologist, that cardiologist has that same record so that they can not start from scratch, but start from where the PCP left off with the patient.
And, of course, in the Affordable Care Act, we have many different levers kind of coming at the hospitals and the providers and patients, for that matter. We've got, you know, these accountable care organizations, which right. are essentially trying to knit together specialists and primary care and hospitals. But we've also tried this before. I mean, we all went through managed care, and patients didn't like that very much. Yeah. So, yeah, maybe, Marty, what's different this time?
I don't know if I'm going to answer that one, but I wanted to pipe in the patient's perspective, which is based on recent personal experience. I was up in Seattle helping take care of my mother-in-law, who 92 and had a heart attack. Sitting in the hospital, and all of her family, she's a big family, stuffed into intensive care room, mom on ventilator. And we're trying to figure out what questions to ask the doc when he comes in and graces us up with 10 or 15 minutes of his time, if we're lucky. And then doc goes away, and we spend the rest of the night contemplating all of the implications for what happens tomorrow when mom goes off the respirator. What do we do if she doesn't breathe? And I guess from a patient's perspective, there's a lot of caregiving that goes on that has nothing to do with medical professionals. And in this day and age, I think you'll all kind of agree that the supportive care team is spread all over the country. And this is an opportunity, I think, for information technology to find a way to be able to bring the family together, not just those who can stuff into the emergency room. And that's where we can to worry about advanced care directives, and we can worry about being able to provide information or advice on what questions to ask the physician and how to make decisions based when you get the answers. I mean, this information technology has many roles to play. But, you know, this whole system is going to fall apart if it's not for the 60 million people who volunteer their time to take care of parents and grandparents and so forth.
Sean, did you want to add something?
I wanted to chime in on the patient-centered medical home because at its core, I think it's just an amazingly sexy and awesome concept that I think could be progressed in a really interesting way. And Wayne, you might know better than me, but it seems like a delivery entity can apply for patient-centered medical home recognition by meeting certain standards. And the standards are very patient-friendly. It's online scheduling. It's communication between different providers. It's the sort of thing where patients out there should be demanding that their care is provided by a patient-centered medical home. But when you go out and talk to people who are in the primary care world and they're looking for doctors, the first thing they think of when they hear the words patient-centered medical home is a house, a funeral home. It's incredibly unclear to what that is. And I think taking the concept of a patient-centered medical home and just bringing it through a rebranding where it becomes this amazing gold seal that all of the best primary care centers out there have will spark some of the consumer demand, which will prompt some of the financial reform required in order to make it an actual practicing reality.
Yeah, it needs a much different name.
But isn't part of the problem... Oh.
I was going to suggest Good Medicine as a name.
Yeah, there you
go. It's good. This is a Good Medicine approved primary care center.
But isn't
everybody knows that that's right. what they need to ask for when they go look for their doctor.
Yeah. But isn't part of this problem, though, that we have a lot of one-off solutions, right? I mean, part of the problem, particularly on the health IT side, is that there are so many people who have all started businesses, and they're good people, and they have they have found funding, but there isn't necessarily anything to knit them together. I mean, even we're talking about building these exchanges, right, for 2014, when people can go online and see if they qualify for a federal subsidy or if they qualify for Medicaid. And, you know, the RFPs have gone out for that. And it's mind-boggling when you think about 50 states all having 50 different exchanges and then trying to knit those together. I think to some extent, isn't the problem that there are just too many kind of upstarts and not enough, you know, almost sort of consolidation?
Patients, again, have something that they can contribute here because, you know, when I was going through my cancer journey, My medical record was not electronic. It was that thick. And it actually got lost. I didn't care. No one ever looked at the stuff. The point is that the amount of information that's needed is, you know, the front page. That's the continuity of care. What's the problems that the patient is facing, you know, urgently? And who are the medical professionals who are involved and so forth? And I think that that's, you know, in order to be able to make this work, we can spend a lot of money and a lot of time figuring out how to build the integrated medical record system in the sky. But given the fact that there's not all that much useful information in these medical records anyway, we can try a different approach in which the patients take the primary responsibility and their caregivers for capturing the information and communicating it among the people in their care circle. Now, in a sense, this is what Google and Microsoft and others tried with their projects like Health Vault and so forth. And the problem was that there wasn't any particular driver to drive the use of those things in a non-acute setting. I think if we try to take those same concepts and reinvent them for urgent care, ICU, and the transition out of it again, we might have better luck. We certainly, that's what we're trying to do in cancer.
Well, we actually have a lot of questions, so let's maybe get to some questions and we'll see where that takes us. This is a question for you, Dr. Brokaw. The audience member wants to know, who pays for your services, the patient, the family? Is your outside independent advocacy covered by any insurance policies?
That's a good question. We are completely an out-of-pocket pay service, which is a really a two-edged sword. We wish we could offer our services to a broader scope of people, but there are real advantages to it, too. We don't answer to anyone but the person who's paying us. We have no perverse incentives whatsoever. And that really, it really does come in handy. I think of the times that we've been involved in some critical decision-making for patients around the end of life. And there tends to be a lot of paranoia that happens when the doctors come in and say, there's nothing left we can do. And typically some family member just has some suspicion that they're not being told everything or that there really is something left. But when we come in as the advocate and talk to everybody and gather the information and spend the time to communicate with the patient's family about what's really going on, they believe us, and they believe us because, you know, they know we're working for them. We signed a contract with them. And the other area that I think it's really important that we're in out-of-pocket pay is in this concept of shared medical decision-making. We have a vision going forward that we'd like to be a resource for patients all over the country in evidence-based medicine and, you know, an interpreter of the literature so that, you know, when they get their two or three opinions that are always varied, and you should get two or three opinions if you're dealing with something serious, we can sit down and interpret those opinions with you and help you decide based on what your goals are for your care and what your belief systems are. So that's a long answer to the question that insurance does not cover us. There are maybe one or two billing codes that we could use, but they don't pay very well, and that's part of the problem, too. And we've just chosen to stay out of pocket.
So the next question is that all the presenters here, and I don't know, Marty, you can clarify this if you're not, all presenters here are for-profit. Are you a for-profit company?
No. Cancer Commons is a not-for-profit.
Okay. Well, so maybe this excludes you. But nonetheless, so most of the presenters are for-profit. Is this a contradiction in good care for community, i.e., I assume they're saying that obviously you're trying to make money off of the products that you're selling. Is there a way in which you are just simply adding to our cost problem, or can you guarantee us that you're going to lower our insurance premiums? Sean?
I can talk. So our company is in a rather fortunate place in that there's been a number of ROI studies done on the original diabetes prevention program, this trial. And they've spoken very favorably of the economics at a certain threshold, which we're hoping to be able to hit because we're delivering this online. So if we can hit the same primary outcomes as this clinical trial, it's easy for us to make an argument that the ROI holds. In terms of us being a for-profit versus a nonprofit, very early on, as our company was being formed and we were thinking of ideas for what to do in this space, we felt very convinced that we had to find a business model that fit into an ROI framework that self-insured employers and insurance companies could be comfortable with, because I don't think it's a reasonable goal to deliver prevention at the scale that it needs to happen in the U.S. if you don't have the financial incentives aligned. And, you know, theoretically, the more people we can bring through our system and the more entities we can convince to pay for it, the more people we prevent from getting diabetes. So it's a rather nice alignment that I don't think you find in too many places, but for us it works.
And have you found so far in your work that there's certain populations that this seems to work for, or is this really a population-based tool? It's going to work in South L.A.? It's going to work in Fresno?
Sure. So it would be helpful to just give a little context for how this feels from the patient's standpoint. So if you find out you have prediabetes, we take people with prediabetes and we match you up algorithmically, kind of like Match.com, into groups of about 10 people. And then we bring you all through the curriculum from this clinical trial at the same time with the help of a health coach.
This is all being happened online. Okay.
Who's involved in working with not just one group but many groups.
And the health coach is a real individual.
It's a real individual.
It's not a computer program.
It's a real individual. We're not a static app.
The Twinkie.
We're an IT-enabled service because it takes that. It really takes that. It's not – behavior change is the mother of all design challenges, and it requires brute force. And if you look at the literature around it, it's you need social relationships, social accountability, and someone to work with. And so that's the person that does it. And so we are what we're attempting to do is tricky because we have to facilitate the relationships that are necessary to have a behavior change model that works, but all online. So we theoretically will be able to deploy this wherever. And the coach could be remote, they could be local, doesn't matter.
Yeah, it's interesting. So again, just because I'm just was down in L.A., so I was at Martin Luther King in South L.A., right? MLK Hospital, which was disastrous, and now they're rebuilding it. So this is this outpatient clinic that they've created out of the old hospital, and they're doing this. But they're doing it in real life. Yep. They bring 10 patients in.
Yep.
They have a medical assistant, this newly created position. And they're doing all that. Okay, so let's go on. Another question here. Is there any way for a patient to get a list of charges with explanations of treatment that they will be getting? oh, you want that? Even for simple things like related costs for lab tests. And then it says, P.S., a timeline for future bills would also be nice. duly noted.
Yeah, it's really incredible how little we understand about our healthcare. I mean, if I were to ask this room if you knew to the dollar how much was spent on you personally by your insurance company for your healthcare last year, I doubt any of you could tell me. And even worse, doctors have no idea how much they spend of our total healthcare dollars when they order tests. And there's new efforts being made to really bring that back. I mean, the 1980s, during the managed care revolution, there was this, mother, may I order a CT scan? No, you may not. And that's going to come back in a way. There are going to be flags built into the system, into the electronic health records that say, this patient had an MRI last month. Why are you reordering an MRI? Or, this medicine that you're ordering costs $200 a month. Could you use this less expensive alternative? So it's coming back. The price awareness is coming back. I think ultimately the consumer has to come to the table, though. And there are some companies out there now who are doing just that, who are making healthcare costs transparent by using Medicare data, what Medicare is charged by certain hospitals. For instance, within the Bay Area, you could get a colonoscopy at Stanford, you could go to Seton Hospital, or you could go to UCSF, and the charges are divergent. It's, I won't say which is the most expensive, but you might be able to guess. And so when those charges are transparent to the self-insured employers that are big purchasers of healthcare, guess what? They're going to say, Dr. X or Hospital X, why are you charging three times as much as this other hospital? And, you know, the answer might be, well, we're better at it, and this is why. And that would be a valid response, but show us the data.
So just before we go on, I just need to remind a little reminder for our radio audience. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today's discussion focuses on new innovations to approaches in patient care and advocacy. We're here with Dr. Jennifer Brokaw, founder of Good Medicine, Mr. Sean Duffy, co-founder and CEO of Omada Health, Mr. Marty Tenenbaum, founder of Cancer Commons, Dr. Wayne Pan, Chief Medical Officer of Health Access Solutions, and the Chief Medical Officer of Pacific Partners Management Services. I'm Sarah Varney, the health reporter for KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. So let's move on because we've got a lot of good questions, and I won't tell my own personal story about UCSF recently. I'm saving it for the radio. I'm coming after them. So this is a person in the audience. I did not say this. Arrogance within medical practice is a given. How does one change culture to one of teamwork and patient safety and not about egos, i.e. the surgeons? Dr. Pan, maybe?
Dr. Pan is an orthopedic surgeon.
So I'm actually an orthopedic surgeon. So I think part... Yeah. Yeah, I can understand that. So I think part of the issue is here that, you know, we have a provider-centric system, right, where you have to go to a provider to get information. You have to go to the hospital. You have to go to the lab place. And what we need to do is change it to a patient-centric system, which is all about what the patient-centered medical home is. Now, I really don't think that just having a stamp of patient-centered medical home or having it certified is actually what you're gonna actually get or experience that. I think people and practices need to understand that there's really only two questions you need to ask. And the first question is, how does whatever I'm doing benefit the patient? And the second question is, can I make it easier for the patient? And if you could do those two things, you're on the way to patient-centeredness. And this transformation is going to take a long time because providers in the past have been trained to be, you know, you come to me, you sit in my waiting room for 5 hours, I don't care because you have to see me. Now that we have a little bit more openness and we'll have cost transparency, there'll be patients who'll say, well, you know what, I don't really want to sit there for 5 hours. It's not worth my time. My time is just as valuable as yours, and I'm going to go somewhere else. And this sort of customer service model, which is really patient-centric models of healthcare delivery, are going to prevail. And until providers understand that you need to make sure that your patients are comfortable and are being treated properly, will you get to this level where you can actually change patient behavior? And that's really what this is all about.
Yeah, Marty.
Yeah, I'd like to, again, from a patient's perspective, say it's not all about cost. There's an issue of cost effectiveness, mm-hmm. and at many points in my own treatment, I asked my surgeon, is this strategy that we're on cost effective? And he would say no, but it is effective. And the fact that I'm here today and the odds of being alive, having had a liver met in melanoma, less than 1%, something like that. So, you know, one really has to take into account the information that will let you make the best decisions. And so the one connection I'd like to make, I mean, is one thing about medical home, but, you know, if there was a connection to be made, for example, between an organization like Cancer Commons and Good Medicine, it would be about, you said, you know, you get two or three opinions. Two or three opinions is hardly a proper sampling of mm-hmm. the information that's out there. Everyone has their own opinion, and medicine is just a big trial and error game right mm-hmm. now. Mm-hmm. And something everyone should be aware of is that the outcomes from the best docs to the worst docs is a typical bell curve. It could be 5-to-1 mm-hmm. differences. And so it's very important when you have a medical home or what have you to have those decisions informed by knowledge, which is, in fact, based on data, which we just don't have today. And so there's got to be there's a need for initiatives like Cancer Commons, not just in cancer, mm-hmm. but in every disease. Mm-hmm. And it's not just about cost.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to rebut that a little bit because I think one of the issues is if you have If you're operating off of anecdotal information, meaning that the N is less than, you know, is one, essentially, you can potentially drive healthcare costs really extremely high. So the example of, you know, having more than one or two opinions, I mean, if I'm not satisfied, I can go to 10 opinions. But does that, at the end of the day, that's added cost to the system. It's not free. And you may not actually get the true answer. So rather than having, you know, more than one opinion, the idea is to have that one opinion with a shared decision-making process so that the doctor, regardless of what his opinion is, actually goes over the entire literature as much as he can.
There's no way any doctor can keep up with 100,000 articles coming each year. So I wasn't advocating necessarily going to 10 consults, but rather that all doctors should have access to definitive, quantitative information about, and costs are one of the factors, and outcomes are the second component. And then we have to continually update that information based on the experience of every patient. So you talk about an N of one, which is an anecdotal piece of information, and you can't really conclude much from that. Each doctor has their own anecdotes, and they use that in their own practice, right? They say, I've treated some patients, the ones I've treated work better this way than that. I think the opportunity that comes from initiatives like Cancer Commons is to be able to aggregate over thousands or hundreds of thousands of N of ones and be able to, you know, do good science and learning on the basis of that so that we can turn medical care from a guessing game into a science.
Just to build on that, I think you would agree that I think you can build tools and services that use data to make the one, two opinions you get on the side better opinions, right? So there's not so much of a variation
And then don't forget that, you know, a very good source of information is to go out on the patient blogs and be able to find out what your medical peers, your patient peers, have experienced, because you'll learn a lot. These patients, some of them super patients, are going to know a lot more about how to treat this disease than many physicians who maybe only see a case like yours, you know, once or twice in a career.
So we'll move on to another question from the audience member is, shouldn't we just have a universal electronic health record system? I mean, I think about this a lot when, you know, you've got the EHR here and another one here, and they can't speak to one another. I mean, wouldn't this all be so much simpler if there was one medical record system in the United States? But that wouldn't really leave a lot of opportunity for y'all to
sell
your products.
Yeah, I think it's kind of difficult to have that, partially because there are privacy issues. There are also issues of registration. So when you register for your lab test, for example, you may use Mary Smith, and you register for your X-ray, you will say Mary B. Smith. And so having one system to try to reconcile all these different patient records is very, very difficult. And that's what most of the local community regional health information systems are finding right now. So having one system doesn't necessarily address the issue. I think the issue is really empowering the patient really to take charge of this information and having them carry it with them. Because
or if not carry it with them, making sure that every patient, wherever I get tested, that information gets put into a place where it's available not only to my providers, but also to the scientific community, so that it can be re-aggregated and put back together to learn as much as possible.
But what's the reason you wouldn't want? I mean, I don't know that I totally buy this idea that somehow, well, because Mary Smith spelled her name differently. I mean, this happens. We have a database of Social Security numbers, for instance.
Well, we can't use Social Security numbers, and that's part of
it. No. Well, I understand that.
We don't
have
unique patient identifiers. So if we had unique patient identifiers, such as Social Security numbers, then it certainly would be easier to do that. However, the problem is, if I'm a doctor and I'm looking at a chart, let's say the information that Mary Smith brings to me, and somehow Mary B. Smith's information got aggregated in there, and it really wasn't the same Mary B. Smith, then I'd be making decisions based on this data that might not be appropriate for the patient. And there's medical legal reasons for that.
Well, sure. But, I mean, you could presumably, though, I mean, NICE has it, or not NICE, but the National Health Service, they have a system.
Sarah, it would be very, very nice if there was a system that actually was something that was, I would say, useful in informing data-based treatments that everyone should be part of. but there isn't such a system. Most medical record systems allow you to keep records, but you can't, as a doctor, go into that system and ask, based on all patients who have been treated by this institution in a way that's A versus B, which ones did better? You can't answer those questions. These systems are junk, and they should all be thrown out, and we should start over.
Okay, well, let's move on to some more questions. So this is a follow-up from – oh, actually, let's go to this one. How much do your companies discuss the treatment costs so that the patient may hold the reins of the decision to control costs? Dr. Brokaw, do you ever get into that? I mean, this is interesting, right? Because on an individual level, I want everything thrown at me, right? But on a population level, as Dr. Pan was saying, right, we can't possibly afford to just try everything.
Right. Well, we've come across that a few times where a client of ours has had a health plan that was a managed health plan. They developed a serious illness. They wanted to go to a world-famous medical center for a second or third opinion. And in one instance, it made sense for them to go out of their network to get better care. It was just a surgeon that had the most experience in the country, but they had to pay out of pocket. And there was this family, although they were, you know, of means, that it was $85,000 for, you know, treatment. So they had to have a family meeting about pooling resources to pay the ticket. And it turned out to be a decision, a very good decision for this particular patient. And it was just lucky that they had the means to be able to do it. Cost is going to be more and more of an issue for people because, you know, I think that there are going to be a lot more higher co-pays and discretionary healthcare dollars that we'll have that will and I think that that's not a bad thing necessarily. I think if the consumer can bring their weight to this cost equation a little bit and ask, you know, is what I'm getting worth the cost, it will make everyone better and more honest.
Part of my problem with that, though, is that, I mean, I'm a very informed healthcare consumer, and I sometimes go to the doctor, and if I have something done, I have to pay a certain amount, but if something else done, I have to pay another amount. I mean, it's impossible to know necessarily ahead of time, okay, this is what this is actually going to cost me. You know, I went to the dentist today. They said they need to do something to my tooth. I said, how much is that going to cost? It's this amount.
Yes.
I can decide to do it or not do it. But in this, you know, some other case, I don't know.
Well, the problem with healthcare consumerism is that when you're a healthcare consumer, you're sick, right? It's not the time in your life when you can be looking at consumer reports or, weighing cost comparisons. I mean, you know, I was an emergency physician for 15 years, and, you know, patients needed their gallbladder out right then. They weren't going to say, well, I'm just going to go up the street and see how much they're going to charge me. It's a very difficult position to be a healthcare consumer. So really we, in the United States, we rely on our employers to be the consumers for us and to do that that research about what the best value for our health plan dollars is. But you know, really, the individual patients need to assert themselves.
Yeah, there are companies out there like Castlight Health that actually aggregates this data that's made available to employees, which will help them decide, you know, whether you pay $10,000 or $1,000 and whether there's any difference. And that's really the premise for value-based purchasing, which is really trying to understand the value that you're getting and actually understanding in advance what you're paying for.
Yeah. So there's a question about patient compliance, which is interesting. The person says, patient compliance, i.e. follow through for treatment, is appalling. Should non-compliant patients be charged more? And should compliant patients be charged less? It's a bit like charging smokers more for insurance. But it does bring up this good question. We were just talking in the back room beforehand about some of these companies that are working with hospitals to try and figure out how to get patients who are discharged from the hospital from not returning within 30 days because now Medicare is no longer going to pay for that if it's a preventable readmission. And some of these some of the ideas are, you know, you have to watch a video on your screen in your hospital room, and then you have to be tested to see if you actually understood what was told. So who wants to take this question of whether or not it would be fair to say, you know, we told you to do X, Y, and Z. You ended up back in the hospital 4 days later because you didn't.
I might,
Sean,
reframe it a bit as a question such as, you know, how might we encourage better compliance? And I do think financial levers and incentives have a place in that, right? And it could be the stick incentive, like we've just, you know, the question was asked where you leave and you're not compliant, and somehow there's a record of that, and then that affects you financially in a bad way. It could be a positive incentive, and it could be all sorts of other incentives that you could build around it too. I think they do have a place. I would argue that it's important to think of that person's specific situation in life and make sure it doesn't go outside of bounds.
Sure. I mean, I can imagine, my grandfather's about to get discharged from the hospital. Mm-hmm. He's 92. To think that he and my grandmother, who's 90, are going to be able to adhere to all of the things that the discharge team is telling him to do is, sort of impossible.
So I think there's a slippery slope also about charging people that are less compliant more money, because ultimately what will happen is then they won't pay for anything, and then they'll get really, really sick. And then when they get to the hospital, it will be so expensive that it would have cost less money to just keep them at the same level. So, I mean, I think there's, the cost piece is really part of it, but I think ultimately it's about patient behavior. It's about patient change. And until we can get there, all this other stuff is really not going to ultimately change and the cost equation very much.
But what about stuff before the hospital, right? I mean, obviously the stuff Sean's working, the company Sean's started is to try and get at the behaviors that really encourage diabetes. To what extent should doctors, primary care physicians, really, not just the insurance companies, who do in fact have these
financial incentives
and care teams in place where they're calling doctors to make sure, have you screened, your 50-year-old women all for mammograms? When will the doctors really start to say, I'm going to proactively do this?
So when the accountable care organizations actually come into being, the physicians themselves are going to be more interested in that, because ultimately, if you think about what's the relationship between a physician and their patients versus a patient and their health plan, the patient and health plan is a transactional relationship. And so that's why the health plans are not that interested in making sure that long term you do well. They only care about the first quarter or 1 year. Whereas a physician, as long as you're staying in that community, chances are you're going to be staying with that physician for the long period of time. And for them, it's really an incentive to make sure that they stay healthy. And the ACO, or the Accountable Care Organization's structure, allows the physicians to benefit from making sure that the resources are applied to the patients from a long-term perspective, and that will come back to them. So hopefully the ACO movement will be able to take care of some of that information.
Well, I go to a single doc practice, and it's a disaster. So I'm looking for a new doctor. I hope you're not here, Dr. D. So this is a question to the panel in general. Marty mentioned the pivotal and essential role of healthcare IT, such as telehealth and FaceTime to improve care coordination and electronic health records to improve care coordination. But this person is saying, and rightly so, that a patient-driven electronic health record requires high health literacy. And even for patients who are college educated and English speakers, primary English speakers, it's difficult to navigate some of these things. So the question is, for ethnic or underserved or limited English speaking patients, won't this inevitably increase health disparities? And how can we lobby the health insurance payers to start paying for such services, which ultimately saves the system money and makes something sense to invest money in? But anyhow, the point being more that that obviously these systems require high health literacy. Many of us don't necessarily have that.
I think that's a really great point. I think that, and that's absolutely true. There are a lot of problems with the electronic health record. Marty, I know Marty agrees, but we probably see it differently. I see that the electronic health record really has a lot of advantages that we should all endorse, which are that, your health information is available to your physician. They're not waiting for your chart to come from medical records, that everything is aggregated. If you're in a system where the specialists are entering into the same medical record as the primary care physicians, they can read your specialty consultations right there when you walk into the room. The downside is we've lost the narrative. And the narrative turns out to be really important about patients, because even though we're going to sequence all of our genomes, we know that we're more than our genes, and our experiences are more than our lab tests and checked boxes on these electronic health records, which is what they are. Basically, an electronic health record was developed to maximize billing capacity. It really was not built around the patient. It was sold to the public to you know, for these other reasons, but how it's primarily used is to maximize the bill that can be generated.
So you just said in a very elegant way my point. And underscored it. These EHR systems as they exist today should be thrown out.
But yeah. Some of them do make recommendations to physicians.
They do. They do. They're, you know, they're,
it's
technology 1.0. Mm-hmm. If you as a physician get ask for a medical record on a patient that's been generated out of an electronic health record, you would be appalled. And, some of the discharge, paperwork for hospitalized patients that are generated out of electronic health records are just garbage, incomprehensible. So there's a lot of work to be done. They're going to look a lot better in 10 to 20 years, but the narrative, you know, the chicken scratch that the doctor wrote in the margin upside down when he or she was seeing you about, son committed suicide at 17, but, patient still grieving, is really important. And that kind of information is hard to find in the EHR for somebody who didn't click, the right box.
I just wanted to say to your original point about what about underserved populations and illiterate populations. There's tremendously strong patient advocacy groups. In which there are some amazingly dedicated and informed patients who can serve some of the functions of the kind of thing that Dr. Brokaw is talking about with good medicine. And many patients find a way to make use of these. And some of the best are not just about a website. They have live 24/7 help in the middle of the night. If you're a breast cancer patient and you just have a question, it's not going to wait till the morning. Go check out a thing like why-me.org. Incredible what those guys do.
So there's several questions here about end-of-life care, and obviously it's incredibly important to all of us who have aging parents or grandparents or who ourselves are going to face these questions someday. Somebody asked a question about, there was apparently a piece about Oregon's end-of-life communication forms this morning at NPR. You want to know what's going on in California. We actually are just planning a show now on hospice care that's going to air next month. So if you check the CaliforniaReport.org, you can find it there. But let's talk a little bit about end of life. And there's a question for you, Dr. Brokaw. Could you please say something about how you work with adults, with aging parents, or patients facing serious diagnoses who need to make choices?
Yeah, that's primarily what we do. I mean, every day there are a few phone calls from adult children of aging parents wanting to know that they are making the right decisions. This is an incredibly, we are coming into the gray zone in America. Our population is aging fast. One of the things that keeps me up at night is, just because our demographic is changing, we're going to have a lot more dementia. And I think that we really need to think carefully about how we want to care for our seniors. I don't really like the term dementia. Cognitive impairment, I think, is better, who are cognitively impaired. And people think that, that's a normal aging process, but it really isn't. And it will affect a significant proportion of the population, not more than current, but because the numbers of older Americans are going to get bigger, we're going to have a lot bigger numbers of patients or of people living with dementia and cognitive impairment. And we have to think outside the box about how to care for those people and what kind of, ethical considerations we're going to make about medical treatment when people are no longer recognizing loved ones or not able to care for themselves anymore. And a lot of the phone calls that we get at Good Medicine are around adult children who have a very impaired parent that needs a big surgery, and they just somehow feel like that's not right and that maybe they should let them go. But there's a lot of guilt around not doing everything for everyone. And, again, back to advanced care planning, we're really trying to get people to come in earlier. And even with mild cognitive impairment, we're trying to include that person in the conversation to get some sort of meaningful statement so that you know, effectively we're saving emotional trauma for the family and the decision makers down the line. And, you know, quite frankly, we're relieving the medical system of some liability. You know, I think the medical system definitely still operates on a do everything for everyone because the daughter might sue us. And if we, you know, were able to have a different discourse about what the right thing to do for people is at various times of their life, and especially if they're dealing with cognitive impairment or Alzheimer's or dementia, whatever you want to call it, I think we're coming to that point very quickly.
We have time for just a couple more questions. First of all, there's a couple questions about the cost of Dr. Brokaw's services. If you'd like, you can just come see her afterwards and talk with her about that. Or any of the
panelists. It's a bargain.
Yeah. this is a question for Dr. Pan. Do you have internal ratings of the physicians in your group, and where is there accountability based on result?
That's a great question. So we actually do measure our physicians based on quality of care metrics that are actually set by the California IHA, Integrated Healthcare Association, pay for performance. So they get measured and bonused on those measures as well. And then we also have a measurement on patient satisfaction, which we do both an external quality test as well as an internal review. And we send patient questionnaires following visits. And so we do that.
And physicians have just notoriously, in some cases for good reason, really bristled at these kinds of reviews, both patient satisfaction surveys, right, which are, you know, can oftentimes just be whether or not they said hello and were nice to you. But then also, you know, physicians don't necessarily want somebody looking over their shoulder. Is that attitude changing, do you think?
So I don't think the attitude has changed a whole lot because, you know, as you know, physicians are trained really to be the person to, you know, they're the experts, so they should know. However, that being said, I think some of the quality measures really need to look at what are they actually measuring. And so if I'm a primary care doctor and I'm telling my patients to go see a GI doctor just to get their colonoscopy, but the patient just happens to, like, not want to do a colonoscopy, that is counted against the physician as if the physician never said anything to the patient. So I think the quality measures have to be looked at from a standpoint of did the physician adequately educate the patient on those things to do, and then whether the patient decided to do that. Those are two different things, and unfortunately they're actually incorporated all on the physician side. And so I think that's what a lot of physicians are sort of upset about, because they don't really accurately reflect what they're trying to do in terms of managing their patients.
But to what extent, where, you know, as I said, that the sort of the one doc shop is somewhat endangered, and
sure,
we have more and more physicians forming these physician groups.
Right.
Presumably, they're bringing in software to evaluate. And I've seen this certainly, and been to accountable care organizations and watched these meetings where the doctors all get together and somebody, shows them their numbers publicly.
So we actually, our group is actually formed of individual physicians. So we do have that oversight, and we provide our physicians a dashboard, essentially, of all their patients that are being managed by us. And so they know which patients of theirs don't have the services and which ones that still need it. And same thing with health plans. Health plans will actually send information out to even single doc practices to say, you know, by the way, you have three people that still need diabetes tests, and that's information that they should choose to obviously work on.
And, of course, the trick is making sure that they have an administrative staff that's aligned around getting those things in play.
Right.
Well, unfortunately, we've reached the end of our program. I want to thank our panelists. We have Dr. Jennifer Brokaw, founder of Good Medicine, Mr. Sean Duffy, co-founder and CEO of Amada Health, Mr. Marty Tenenbaum, founder of Cancer Commons, Dr. Wayne Pan, chief medical officer of Health Access Solutions, and the chief medical officer of Pacific Partners Management Services. And we also thank our audiences here and on the radio. Thanks to the California Healthcare Foundation for underwriting this program. I'm Sarah Varney, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.